There's a new exhibition at the Yukon Archives in the Dodd Center for Human Rights commemorating the 50th anniversary of the 1974 Black Student Sit-In at the Wilbur Cross Library, where about 370 students occupied the library over 2 days to demand diversity hiring, enrollment, and representation in resources across the campus for Black and Brown students. There is an exhibit going on right now at the Dodd Center to commemorate this anniversary. Graham Stennett joins me today, an archivist from the Dodd Center at the University of Connecticut. Graham, welcome back. Thank you for joining me again today. Does what's going on right now at Yale and Columbia kind of have similar overtones to what happened 50 years ago at the University of Connecticut?
Thanks for having me on, Wayne. It's good to be back as well. Yeah, I mean, always university campuses are sort of growth spaces for folks to come, bring their existing feelings, experiences to that new community and try and carve a way for building new coalitions, new solidarities. You end up seeing this a lot in 1974 between the Puerto Rican students and the Black students at that time, both minority students by a long shot and really not seeing themselves in the campus itself.
I'm intrigued by the title of your exhibit, Please Respond Personally. Why is it called that?
So there was several actions that the students organized across this 6 month or so period where they were building up to kind of having a dialogue with the administration. One of those actions was a letter writing campaign where they each had sort of gotten a form letter. They each sort of wrote at the bottom specifically their name, but also please respond to me personally. They were giving this to President Ferguson as soon as he arrived at his office at Gully Hall, and each of them kind of saying, look, we all have the same concerns, but I am an individual and I need to be spoken to about my concerns.
Did President Ferguson respond to any or all of them?
Maybe as a broad memorandum, he would sort of write as a response. No one individually, as far as I'm aware, at least in our records in the archives, got an individual response that ended up back in the collection. And that was a big part of why they organized a demonstration to sit in at the Wilbur Cross Library shortly thereafter.
Tell me about what you've been able to find from that. You make it sound like sometimes stuff from 50 years ago isn't always accessible. Sounds like you found some stuff.
Yeah, so we have a set of photographs in our university photograph collection, and typically this covers a period that you're maybe more familiar with, the 1960s, late 60s anti-war activism. We're chock full of students going to the president's office, taking over space, organizing, demonstrating. And we have a very small slice that actually represents this sit-in where these 219 or so Black students are carried out by Connecticut State Police from the library, and there was almost no documentation about where these photographs came from. So that kind of just began this unwinding of how do we find the paper trail to give us a beat-by-beat historical account of what led up to this event.
And from what I read, it seems as if this protest by the Black and Brown students in 1974, from the beginning, was designed to be peaceful, nonviolent. That's a big part of this, isn't it?
That's correct. I think they were such a strong, interconnected community at that time. There's maybe about 600 African-American students in 1974 at the UConn campus. About half of them had organized to do this kind of action. That's a very significant portion of that community at the time. They all knew each other. They were all very connected in their student activities, their student life very much overlapped. They saw themselves in each other and built that community together. And because of that, they didn't want to maybe throw out the gains that they had made up to that point. So going the direction of maybe the more civil rights-oriented actions versus the Black nationalism that was from the late 1960s that had far more connotations of maybe a more overt violence, they saw those measures as being a stronger way to achieve their gains. And ultimately, you put the onus on the police and the administration physically removing you from a space. That sends a much stronger message than someone throwing a rock through a window.
And I've had many conversations with the late, great D. Rowe, the former UConn men's basketball coach, including right here in the studio. About those tumultuous times, the social activism, that it wasn't just a matter of guys going to class and guys playing basketball and going back to their dorm. A lot of those guys were big into that stuff, and that was when the African Americans began to be prominent on UConn's men's basketball team. And one of the people who was involved, of these 370 or so students at the takeover of the UConn library, was one of his players. Tell me about Rodney Bass.
Rodney Bass is a really interesting character. He is sort of an essential student at this time who overlaps with a lot of the student activities as well as his athletics. He was at UConn up until 1975 is when he graduated with his BA. He was on an academic scholarship. So unlike a lot of the other basketball players who were there to just play ball, they had a little bit more risk going into these kinds of actions. What was the coach going to say? What was the administration going to say as far as funding goes for these guys if they ended up being arrested for something like this? Rodney felt like he had a little bit more flexibility because he got there through academics. Basketball was maybe the secondary reason why he was able to come to UConn. But he still caught hell for doing it. Him and D-Row sort of didn't see eye to eye, of course, after that. They formed their relationship and really, you know, buried the hatchet many years after that. But Rodney's a really interesting person because he also has this organizing aspect through the Organization of African American Students, which was much more of a civil rights-oriented style of student activism group on our campus, started in the late 1960s. Really led the measures to bringing in more black and brown students to enrollment, making sure that something like the African American Cultural Center gets established, and that there are resources for black students to more or less thrive in an academic setting.
Is that organization still viable? Did it morph into something else?
I think largely the NAACP is what we would see as the sort of coefficient of that organization. It didn't last much further into the 1970s. The African American Cultural Center actually became more of this organizing space for groups that had those concerns. And then, of course, as you start to see these diversity hiring initiatives, it really starts to just become part of the institution in a lot of ways, as it's supposed to, right? This is what the integration of an academic institution is supposed to do, bring in all of these voices so that we don't have to continuously sort of carve out space like that.
I looked up Rodney Bass's numbers last night because I have all that stuff. And in his junior year, 74, averaged, I think it was 1 point a game. In his senior year, 75, he averaged about 1.6 points per game. He didn't get a lot of playing time, but he was a member of those D-Row teams at the University of Connecticut. And Graham, he's done okay for himself since UConn, hasn't he?
Yeah, he was a principal of Stanford Public Schools for a number of years. He is more or less organizing an educational project where he helps educate local folks in Stanford about the history of African American culture, and he organizes study abroad trips for them to go to West Africa to learn about the slave trade, learn about the history of African people, and then its connections to folks in the United States.
Graham, I'm really interested in what the reaction has been or is from African American students at the University of Connecticut now who see this event. Probably didn't know about it until they happen to see this particular display that you've got at the Dodd Center right now. But what are they saying about it? What have they learned about this significant event that happened 50 years ago?
I think it's been really positive. My goal has been to more or less use the documents to do the speaking, especially when it comes to what is the voice that is depicting the students' actions. You know, most of the documents that we have are from the president's office. It's from the university. They're more or less surveillance photographs, trying to like sort of use a microscope on these folks and identify them. So trying to draw in the alumni who are involved and let them do the telling has been like help me do this narrative by incorporating their voices to guide it has probably been the closest touchstone I've had in working with a community and a collection and pairing them together. The other thing I will say, though, is that a big reaction that we're getting is how many of these demands, there were about 12 of them that the students issued in 74, how many of these demands have actually been met? And maybe a third of them have actually had a response. The rest of them are about things that we talk about still today.
You mean some of those things they protested 50 years ago still aren't enacted, still aren't in place at the university?
Or they have currently been repealed. So affirmative action, for example, 1974 is one of these key periods in which, I mean, we see a lot of this stuff. We see Roe versus Wade, it's the same period, 73, affirmative action in 74, there's legislation that had just come up. So in this case, you know, one of their main asks was that the university adopt an affirmative action plan. Now, the university had, but just nationally, I'm saying, the Supreme Court, what, just last fall, repealed the measure to allow affirmative action to be used in campus applications. It's still a very hot button issue. Resources for students, of course, is always a current ask. College is very expensive, and this is not something that has gone down since then.
And you just talked about the photos of the black students being arrested and removed from the Wilbur Cross Library, not the Babbage Library, but in the 70s, they had the new library, the Babbage Library, which had some construction issues. We won't get to that right now. But anyway, they refused to leave when the building closed at midnight. So what was the timetable after the Wilbur Cross Library closed? Did they take them out at 12:01? Were they there at 6 a.m. before they were taken out? And were they taken out in handcuffs? Were they taken out in some sort of physical police custody? How were they removed?
So if we played this out in real time, literally 50 years ago to now, they would still have been sitting in at the library. April 22nd was when they went in, just before closing time. Today is April 23rd. It is now almost 8 a.m. The police would have still been removing them at that time. So they go in about 10 minutes before the first call comes out from the security or librarian in the building that says, you will be trespassing. If the building closes and you remain in it, you need to be exiting very shortly. Rodney stands up. He reads the statement that says, we will not leave this library until President Ferguson comes to meet us to discuss these demands. And then they sit back down and continue studying. This is the first day of finals. They would have been reading their texts, preparing for their exams. They were not intentionally going in there to just, you know, cause a ruckus. They were like, we're gonna do this at an important time, but we also have to prepare for the exams that we have coming up. So this happened just about every hour. Someone would come in, announce that they would be removed or that they needed to leave. Meanwhile, Norman Stevens, the assistant director of the library, who I was able to speak to before he passed about this experience, he said the students were not disruptive whatsoever. And in fact, the library, Wilbur Cross, was kind of in disrepair at that time. They were preparing to build Homer Babbage Library. So he sort of said there was very little damage that they could have done if they had. So anyhow, they eventually get to this point where about 6 a.m., it is stated that there are about 90 state troopers out in the parking lot and that they will be coming in. You have 10 minutes to leave or you will be arrested. That's when many of the athletics folks did leave and the rest of them were carried out.
What was demand number 12 by the black students?
Yeah, this is one that really touches home for us at the archives and the UConn library, is that one of the demands was that there was no representation in the library collections, and specifically the special collections, of representation by black and third world scholars. This is a period in which black studies had more or less been established in most major state institutions, state universities. University of Connecticut also had a black studies department, but the library was slow to catch up to being able to field resources to have these courses be successful, have students have general inquiry and growth in this discipline. It was reported that you had to go to Hartford to find these books, and you know, folks at the University of Connecticut, it was described as a suitcase campus for a long time. Kids would leave on the weekends. There was no dining services on the weekends. So just one more place you would have to go to get your resources is Hartford. And that's not that easy of a trip all the time for students. So they demanded that the library have these things. And I'm here. I can say number 12 was met. Hopefully this exhibition helps flesh that out a little bit.
How do people see this exhibition? How long will it be on display?
So it'll be up until July 19th in the Dodd Research Center at UConn. Please come in Monday to Friday. The gallery is open from about 9 to 4 p.m. We also have a lot of digital representations. I've been kind of building these resources for the last number of years. There are podcast episodes. I've interviewed Rodney. I've interviewed another organizer, Gary King. That just got released. The podcast is called Darshiv. You can find it through WHUS Radio. YouTube videos about this exhibit, about the resources and collections that help you sort of unpack this history, are all available through our website.
Darshiv, which looks very much like D apostrophe archive. We've done a program on that in the past. Graham, of all the things that came out of that, what do you think was the most significant result of this protest by the black and brown students?
Probably the expansion of the African American Cultural Center. It was established in 1968, so before this sit-in, it had kind of been in a place that was accessible, more or less, but it was in one of these row houses that are almost all torn down now. Many purposes used, kind of just a building that was passed off between several different entities. And to try and represent all of the student activities and the sort of culture and life in which these students were trying to form community around, the building was not going to work. They referred to it as the Black House. They would intentionally have media come do interviews with them where all of the kids would cram into this house, literally spilling out of the windows to just demonstrate this space is not adequate for the number of folks on this campus who need a place like this. Eventually, the African American Cultural Center, the H. Fred Simons Cultural Center, was moved to the Student Union and kind of became a more integrated space of the university as a whole, and it remains there today.
370 or so students occupy the library over 2 days. We've used the phrase black and brown. What was the role of Puerto Rican students in this protest?
I think if you were to ask the alumni of that period, they would both say that each of their causes were shared. There was a real solidarity between the Puerto Rican and the black students at that time. The Babbage administration from the mid to late 1960s had the initiative to try and expand enrollment amongst that population to UConn. It was a real actual like driving force for his administration. So those two students kind of started to appear in not similar numbers. There were far more black students than there were Puerto Rican students in the late 60s, early 70s, but they saw their sort of growing community happening cohesively. They both sort of had similar demands about issues of racism in certain departments, such as the anthropology department, access to resources to get those students to the campus, things that's representing them, such as library resources, books about their culture, their history. They were shared issues. So a lot of these movements and direct actions were sort of called out, spread amongst word of mouth, amongst their communities separately, but always kind of rejoining together at those spaces where the event was happening.
So as you identified, it was 50 years ago today that the 370 or so students were actually arrested and taken out of the Wilbur Cross Library on the UConn campus. Were they brought out as one group, or were they brought out like 10 at a time? How did they remove them from the Wilbur Cross?
So the photographs basically depict teams of about four state patrol police coming into the northwest wing reading room of the Wilbur Cross Library, this sort of big cavernous reading room. You probably remember it. And the students were sitting in at that space, and they all kind of took the tactic of just either laying prone, stay put, or stand up and be escorted out. Those who sort of wanted it to be a physical presence issue, they wanted those images of them getting carried out of the library, basically said, you can just pick me up, take me out of this place. If I'm going to be removed, I want to be removed this way. So they would grab them by all four arms, legs, carry them out. Some of them were getting rug burns as they were dragged out, and then carried out down the front steps, then put on commuter buses to then be taken to the Stafford Springs barracks.
370 of them. Stafford Springs had that much room?
They all came in chartered buses at a time, and apparently the buses brought them back to campus after they were booked. So it also disrupted bus service that morning. And again, like I said, this is like the week of finals. There was a very large contingent of students who were very unhappy that they, number one, couldn't get into the library because the police were actively arresting kids, and then number two, that they couldn't get on the buses to get to their classes or get to their study spaces.
All right, so does that go on some sort of permanent record? here 50 years later? Do those students, 370 of them, is that still on their criminal record?
So what ends up happening is that a lot of the students, I heard on a good account, is that when they got to the police barracks, they did not have their identification on them. When there was the final announcement that the police would come and arrest them, they gave their IDs to the students who did not want to be arrested. Those students left out the windows of Wilbur Cross Library. When they were then arrested and taken to the barracks, they were asked what their name was to fill out the police report. Apparently, Ike and Tina Turner were there. Popeye was there. Mickey Mouse was there. So many of these folks gave false names.
Yeah, okay. I got it. For a second, I thought you meant they were really there. Then I realized, that's what they put on the piece of paper.
Exactly. Okay. Rodney, though, who I'd mentioned,
Rodney Bass,
a fairly recognizable, tall individual who played
6'4".
So the bus driver had recognized him, and he couldn't get out of that one. So everyone was more or less charged with criminal trespass. Now, if they weren't able to identify them, the letter wasn't technically sent to them, but 219 that morning, anyways, received a criminal trespass charge. Eventually, though, these charges are nollied. Over the course of the summer, the administration did not want to have this on their hands. The images are very not a PR piece that you want to have in your portfolio as a president, and the charges were eventually dropped. So there was a lot of threat of, dismissal from student life, from your job as a student worker, from the basketball team, you name it. It would not have been a good record to have if you had been charged with that.
You said that some of the students who didn't want to be arrested left through a window, to which I'm thinking, first floor window. Second floor. They didn't jump, did they? It's not...
No, it wasn't that high up, and you can still kind of see them now as they are. They're just above ground level in the Wilbur Cross Library.
Was this significant protest from 50 years ago, yesterday and today, the anniversary, something that had been done elsewhere that the UConn students got the idea, let's try it here because we've got the same issues they do, or was this a first of its kind?
I mean, I could go on about this for a while. I'm going to try and synthesize it. But in a way, this 74 sit-in it's late, technically, for the sort of Black Power movement on campuses, what's known as the Black Campus Movement. This is predominantly happening to coincide with the anti-war movement. A lot of these same issues that the students on UConn's campus were talking about had kind of already been put on display and demonstrated for in many other major universities in the late 1960s. Now, I think it's largely just due to the slow incorporation of a African-American community of students on our campus that leads to this progression to be in 74. But as you well know, as we've discussed, in the late 1960s, taking over Gully Hall, the president's office, was a regular event for predominantly white students who are demonstrating against the war in Vietnam, against campus recruitment to work for petrochemical companies who would then go on to make napalm. This was part of the direct action of that anti-war period. But of course, we have to also go back further to when the civil rights sit-ins are happening in the early 1960s, and before that, predominantly in places in the South. But we kind of need to hone it a little bit closer to this being a student movement, less about Jim Crow segregation, which is the history of civil rights activism, but more about how is this institution not responding to the community members of it.
Did you get the impression through your research that there were white students who sympathized with what the Black and brown students were protesting at the Wilbur Cross Library those days?
I'm glad you asked. So again, if we can go back in our time machine, literally 50 years ago today, April 23rd.
What are you looking at? Tell the people, you're second time you brought your phone up. What's on your screen, which I can't see from here?
I'm just checking the time because, we're playing this thing out as it's happening beat
real
by
time.
Beat 50 years ago.
Yeah, okay.
So the Black students had been removed just about by now. They're at Stafford Springs Barracks being charged. The library is closed for another couple hours to clean up so that students can then come in and begin studying as they normally would. About 8 or 9 hours from now, a contingent of about 90 white students and faculty come back to Wilbur Cross and do the exact same thing as the Black students did the night before. They say, we are in solidarity with the black students that were arrested the night before. We are going to do the exact same thing until Ferguson comes to meet their demands and talk with them, drop the charges, etc. So a real sign of solidarity here between these otherwise factions, at least, of the student movement of that time. But, you know, the issues from the late 60s and the war in Vietnam, yes, that issue was resolved, but so many other cultural things were still yet unresolved. They wanted, predominantly white students, wanted the campus bookstore to become a cooperative. That is happening this exact year. The corporation that ran it at that time, Follett's, was eventually, their agreement was not renewed, and it became a cooperative bookstore in which we all owned a piece of it as students, as faculty, as staff members as well. That's what's happening at this time, too. The representation of women's voices, LGBT student concerns. This is all kind of part of this mixture of how the university is a little microcosm of how sort of the nation and its society of people are forming their communities and bringing their voices to the fore.
With this significant protest that took place on yesterday and today's date and 50 years ago, was there any damage done to the Wilbur Cross Library other than those rug burns you talked about when they were dragging kids out?
None, other than the causes of the students being pulled out by the police. Maybe a periodical here or two was knocked over in the transportation by the police of the students out the door. But as I mentioned, I have on good authority from Norman Stevens, who was the assistant director of the library doing the go-betweens between the students and the police at that time. He said the students were perfectly behaved. And in fact, their plan was to leave before the building was reopened because they didn't want to more or less make enemies of the students who were just wanting to come back in and begin their normal day of study, preparing for finals. That communication got lost between who made the order for the police to come in and the students who were basically ready to allow the next group to come in so that they didn't upset the apple cart.
Now, this display will be open until July the 19th, Monday to Friday, 9 to 4, at the Dodd Center. And so much of what you put together is a photographic archive of this event. Who took the pictures?
So, this is kind of the thing that I am working on still, and it's the real issue that I have with how we even have these photographs in the first place. I have on some good authority, at least, of a lead that it was a contract photographer who worked for the Advance, or what used to be called the Connecticut Chronicle. It was the faculty and staff newspaper that was produced by the university. They would have been called at about 2 a.m. to come in to begin taking photographs. The photographs themselves are, on the one hand, sort of framed very nicely. There's some very good images here that would actually like hold up as a photographic depiction of a moment. But then the vast majority of them are these very blurry shots. They're just shots literally intended to catch the face, make sure that we have the identity of who this individual is, for what purpose, we don't have a record of. I'm still trying to comb that out. But I have at least some information that makes me believe that it is an individual who worked for that paper and possibly was a contract photographer for the Hartford Courant as well. Working with Mark Roy on that, I'll just say that he's been my tip. So,
man knows everything about UConn. In fact, he wrote a book, History of the University of Connecticut. You, by the way, could write one yourself, my friend. The names that are associated with these 370 students who protested on yesterday's date 50 years ago, are any of them public to the point where maybe some of them who were involved 50 years ago don't want their name being public? Then how do you handle that?
Right. I mean, it's a real issue with what these photographs and just archival collections in general represent. Who is consenting to this image being used in what scenario? From our standpoint, you know, these photographs were taken without their consent. The action, though, that they are taking now kind of represents a liberatory force within the collection itself. They were doing this on their terms, right? They intentionally made this move, and they wanted people to know about it. They were calling journalists while they were inside the library to be sure to be out that front door when they got hauled out so that their photograph could be taken, at least of the representation of them being pulled out. So there's a couple ways to kind of read this record, I think, but the way that I have been seeing it and the way that the alumni who I've brought to the exhibit see it, they're struck by it. They find this to be a very interesting and powerful example of the action and energy that they put into organizing this very event. And they more or less got the outcome that they wanted. And I think through their sort of consent, in a way, I'm seeing the role of the archivist kind of being able to use the records to help tell these stories so people are, aware all of a sudden that there was this level of activism at that time.
And again, tell the people how and when they can see this display.
Yep, at the Dodd Research Center at the University of Connecticut, Monday through Friday, 9 to 4. It's in the archives gallery, the Schimmelfing Gallery. You can engage with it in person, but also there are electronic resources. The podcast that we run out of the archives, Dar Shiv, has a couple of episodes where we've interviewed alumni who were part of the organizing. There are all kinds of resources to access the physical material, but through digital capabilities. We've digitized almost the entire exhibit in a way. You can find all of the photographs we've been talking about today on our website at the UConn Archives.
And the display is called Please Respond Personally. That's what the students wrote to President Glenn Ferguson, commemorating the 1974 Black Student Sit-In, which took place on yesterday and today's date in 1974. Graham, fascinating stuff, and I think it's something everybody should take a time and go see at the Dodd Center at the University of Connecticut. Graham Stennett, Curator of Human Rights Collections and Alternative Press Collections, Archives and Special Collections at UConn's Thomas J. Dodd Research Center on WILI.